Okay, this is January 14th, 2016. We're at the Kinsley Library, and I'm Joan Weaver, and Rosetta Graff is also in the room, and we are interviewing John J. Riso today. Okay, John J., you want to say your whole name?
John J. Riso.
And when were you born?
4/9/26.
And where were you born?
North of Ophelia.
Okay. Now, your ancestors came to this area about when?
1884. My granddad came over from Riso Island next to Haugesund, Norway.
Norway. Oh. See, I'm going to learn lots of things here. In 1884, and was your grandfather married at the time?
No.
Okay. And what was his name?
His name was John J. Riso also. It was really John Johannes Riso. But Johannes in Norwegian is John. So I don't understand that.
You didn't want to be called John John?
Well, I don't know. I've been called everything, that included. But anyway, I was going to tell you something, mm-hmm. but I can't remember what it was now.
Well, about him coming over?
Well, he was a, granddad was a navigator and sailed around on ships. And he got out of navigation school. Now, this is one place Julie and I are a little at odds. I claim he got out of navigation school at 12 and he went to sea at 14. And Julie thinks he got out of school at 14 and went to sea.
Yeah. Either way, he was young.
Yeah, okay. All I know is what granddad told me. Mm-hmm. And she's probably right. Anyway, he sailed around Cape Horn 9 times.
Now, he was on commercial ships, or...
He was on sailing ships.
Yeah, but they were private, doing commerce, or... He wasn't in the Navy.
I have no idea.
Oh, okay.
No, he wasn't in the Navy.
Right.
It was a ship carrying...
Mm-hmm. Carrying goods.
Goods, yeah. Back and forth between Norway and... They probably brought over a lot of fish.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know what all they had in Norway, but that, and then when they went back, they took other things, you know.
About what year would this be, do you think?
Well, Granddad was born in 1861, which was the year Kansas became a state. And he was born April 10th in 1861, which is just a day from my birthday, which is nice.
Mm-hmm. Easy to remember. You're doing very well on dates.
And he, I guess he won the farm because when he got to the United States, he never went through Ellis Island. Either he or Grandma. Now, I don't know how they managed that. But that's Uncle Pete always said that Granddad jumped ship.
Well, that's pretty early.
Well... I don't know.
So Ellis Island probably wasn't working at that time.
Well, I don't know. Anyway, so he went to the Dakotas in New England, North Dakota, which is right on the line between North and South Dakota. And he had a nephew and a niece, Jack Johnson and Signa Johnson. And they were granddad and grandma's niece and nephew. But I got to clarify this. There was so many Riso kids on the island that was just off of Haugesund, Norway. You had to take a boat to get to it, but it was rock close. There was so many Riso kids that the teacher named half of them, or where they had same first names, she named them, some of them, Johnson.
Oh.
And so they kept those names. And so Granddad had purebred brothers that were Johnsons and had brothers that were Risos. But his dad's name, which was John Thomason Riso, was a Riso. And Riso Island was spelled R-I-S-O-E-N. And I don't know whether that's got any difference between the way Norwegians... I don't know what the deal is on that. But our name is spelled R-I-I-S-O-E. And when I was in the Navy, I looked for the Risos in New York City because I knew there was one. there was a guy by the name of Pete Riesel that was a sea captain, and he lived in New York City. But he never had any kids, and nobody knows anything about his wife, or if he was ever married, or I assume he was, but God only knows. Mm-hmm. But I could not find them. But there's several pages of RIIS, and those people are all from Finland.
Okay, so he came to the United States and went right to North Dakota, did
North
you
Dakota.
And where he had nephew.
It was too cold there.
You know what year that was about?
Well, that'd be in 1884.
Right before. He didn't stay then.
No.
Okay.
And anyway, I assume that's what it was, because he came here in 1884.
Okay.
Anyway, then he went down to Iowa, Garden City, Iowa, where his brother, and I think his name was Seaman Johnson, lived. And Garden City, Iowa, is about 45 miles from Des Moines, north. And he gave the land for the cemetery, and Marge and I were up there, and he's got the biggest tombstone you ever saw, and it's the biggest one in the whole cemetery, and he gave the land for the cemetery. And it's a pretty good size, probably 20 acres at least.
Okay, so then John came down here.
And then it was too cold there for him, so he come down to Kansas. And he got off the train at Brenham, which is about 10 miles, maybe 7, 8, I don't know how far, east of Greensburg. Okay. And he inquired if there was
any... What train? No, that's not the Santa Fe. Yes.
It was
Union Pacific down there.
Okay, all right, yeah.
Okay.
Anyway, he inquired if there was any land. And they said no, but there was some at Kinsley. So Granddad walked through the sandhills all the way to Kinsley. And Uncle Pete said, how in the hell come he didn't get lost? And I said, well, you've got to remember, Granddad was a navigator. And if a navigator knows what he's doing, there ain't no way you can lose him. But he walked, and I suppose that's probably close to 40 miles.
From Brennan, yeah.
Yeah. Anyway, he walked through the sand dunes and hit Kinsley and inquired if there was any land available. And they said that there was a quarter, 4 miles north of Kinsley. So he went out there and bought this quarter of land for $500. He bought what they call it now. I'll think of it after a while.
So it wasn't part of the homestead?
No, a guy that was homesteading it, but he just started homesteading it.
And so
Granddad bought the preemption rights to this quarter for $500. And the guy that lived on it had already planted the 10-acre tree claim, which was in the northeast corner of this quarter, and it's not there anymore. Anyway,
and he was a bachelor at this time.
He was a bachelor, and he lived in this dugout. And I imagine the guy that owned the land was the one that built the dugout, mm-hmm. presumably. And it was in the southwest corner of the quarter, in the side of a small hill, and. And then, in 1885, he sent for Grandma, and
she was back?
What?
Where was Grandma?
Grandma was in Norway.
She was back in
Norway. She lived on Riso Island also. And her name was Kolsta, Martha Kolsta.
Can you spell that?
K-O-L-S-T-O. K-O-L-S-T-O. Anyway, so Granddad sent for her in 1885, and I don't know just one he sent for, but the way, I don't know how they got together in Norway, but Grandma was looking out the window one day and she saw Granddad spading a garden, and she told her girlfriend that that's my man. And she got it. And
that would have been quite a trip for her to come over.
Yes.
Do you know if she came with other people or was she alone?
No, all by herself. Anyway, she came a day early, and a guy by the name of Lars Olsen went over and looked at this tag that she had hanging around her neck with her name on it, and then talked to her. Of course, he was a Norwegian too. And he talked to her and found out that she was going to be married to Grandpa Riso. And so he went out and got Grandpa, and Grandpa came in, and they got married immediately. And they got married on the third day of August in 1885.
And where did they get married?
Here in Kinsley.
In a church?
I have no idea.
Justice of the Peace? Nothing about that?
I have no idea. Probably was a minister. And probably, if the Congregational Church was here at that time, that's probably where they got married.
Might have been.
You know when it was built?
We can look that.
Yeah, anyway, where was we at?
Well, they were getting married.
They got married. Anyway, a woman by the name of Doakes that lived right south of where Granddad lived in the dugout, in the trees that's owned by Orangemen now. But this family of Doakes, D-O-A-K-S, were the ancestors of Steve and Bill and Paul Owens. And Steve and Bill were football players
yeah,
for the New York Giants.
Yeah, we've got a file on them.
And Steve was huge, mm-hmm. And Bill wasn't much smaller.
I've got pictures of them in our file.
They were really big guys.
Yeah.
Anyway, they called Paul Squirt because he was only about 6'2" and weighed about 220 pounds.
He was smaller,
but they called him Squirt.
Okay, so he took her home to his dugout. Do you have any stories?
Well, anyway, I want to tell you a little more about the wedding dinner.
Oh, okay.
This woman made this wedding dinner and had it all sitting on the table and everything and waiting for Grandma and Grandpa to arrive, and a big dog jumped through the window and lit on the table and tipped it over and just scattered everything and ruined everything. But the lady got everything in order and kicked the dog out and still had the wedding dinner. So she must have been quite a gal.
Yeah. I think your grandmother was quite a gal. Are there any stories about when she first saw that dugout or life out in the dugout, what it was like in the early days?
Except that they lived in that dugout, and I don't know just how long, and I don't know how many kids were born in the dugout, but I have a suspicion there was about two. You've heard of the blizzard of 1886?
Yes.
Well, Grandma and Grandpa went to bed early in the evening because the dugout would get dark.
It
only had a couple of windows, I suppose. Hard on it. It may have had none. I don't know.
Yeah, might not have.
See, anyway, they went to bed early, and so they woke up, and it was 8 o'clock, but it was pitch black. And so they stayed in bed all day long. And lo and behold, it got to be 8 o'clock again, and Granddad got up and went to the door, and it was nothing but snow. The whole thing was covered up with snow. And to me, it's a wonder they didn't smother.
Mm-hmm.
But I suppose...
Maybe the chimney.
Probably the roof.
And the chimney was sticking up.
And the chimney was sticking up, and no fire.
Did they have livestock at that time? Did they lose cattle or chickens?
I don't know. The only livestock I ever knew they had that they lost was they had a team of horses that the granddad gave $500 for, and one of them fell in a dug well that they had there and died. And a lot of people asked me if he ever got it out of the well, and I said, I have no idea. Probably not. They probably just moved the well.
So how many children did they have?
Well, they had 6 kids. After this 1886 blizzard, Uncle Johnny Riso, whose name was John Jay also, was born in 1887. And then Aunt Minnie was born in 1889. And then Uncle Oscar was born in 1891. And this was at the time that I think, sometime in that year, they moved up to where the farm is now. Because Granddad told me that he put the windmill up on there in 1891. And that windmill is still standing there. It's not the same head on the windmill, but it's a 3-legged tower. And when you get up on it, it shakes and wobbles and everything else. And there's been many tornadoes went through there. And it withstands them. I guess it gives enough. But it's almost, I hate to crawl up on it. Of course, Glenda hates to crawl up on it too because it's so wobbly. But it's a good windmill. Mm-hmm. And anyway, where are we at now?
Yeah, that was 3 kids, and then I think.
Okay, then in 18. I was up to 1891.
Mm-hmm.
In 1893, Aunt Edna was born, Edna Riso. And then in 1895, my dad was born. And then
and his name?
Fridjof Nansen was his name.
What's that first name?
Fridjof, F-R-I-D-J-O-F.
And the middle name?
Nansen, N-A-N-S-E-N. And Dad was named after a famous explorer that actually discovered the North Pole the year Dad was born, or maybe a year afterwards, because he was missing at the time Dad was born, and that's why Granddad and Grandma named my dad after him, because he was a great explorer. And he made it through the winters at the North Pole by, yeah, there was a Eskimo guy that they were friends, and they slept together to keep each other from freezing to death. And then when he returned to Norway after 2 years' time, why, they welcomed him back and gave him a lot of money. And he spent the rest of his life just giving money away. He was a philanthropist.
Mm-hmm.
Give money away all the time. And I don't know where he got it, except people gave it to him.
Or he maybe invested. Now, were you the youngest, or is there one more after you?
No, we're talking about my dad.
Or your dad,
yeah,
rather,
yeah, Uncle
you.
Pete was born in the year 1900.
Okay.
Yeah, he was 5 years later. He always said he was probably an accident. Did you know him?
Yeah.
I thought you did.
What was it like growing... Well, no, this is your dad still we're talking about.
Yeah.
And then your dad married whom?
He married... Louise, her name was Louise Dorothea Deers.
D-E-E-R-E-S?
No, D-I-E-R-S.
Oh, D-I-E-R-S. Glad I asked that. And where was she from?
She was born here. My mother, Louise, or everybody called her Lucy, was born a Katz. And her mother was a Brame girl. B-R-E-H-M. And also, Grandma Deers was a Bram girl, so they were sisters. My mom's mother died when Mom was three. And so her aunt, which was Grandma Deers, raised her as her own.
And so then her name changed to Deers.
They changed it. She was never legally adopted.
Mm-hmm.
And when Dad died and Mom and I went over to apply for Social Security, we went over there five or six times.
I can imagine.
Because she had a birth certificate since she was born, Louise Dorothea Katz, and she was married as Louise Dorothea
Deers.
And the guy just threw his hands up. And so we would come back to Kinsley and get some more information. And, you know, they never legally adopted her. We tried the school records because she went to school at district number 37, the same school I went to, because she lived across the section a mile east of the schoolhouse. And so she walked to school every day, and Uncle Fred Deers, which was her brother, taught school there for, I don't know, a few years.
Mm-hmm.
And then where I was born and raised was about a quarter of a mile northeast, mostly north of the schoolhouse.
So did your mom and dad, they both went to school there?
No. Dad went to school out here at the school out here by Woodson Kingery's place. I can't think of the name of it. The number, I mean.
We can look that up.
Yeah, okay.
I guess, can't we?
District 3, I think it was. I'm not sure about this.
No, sir.
You can write it down.
Yeah, we'll look it up.
Yeah. Anyway, I think it was District 3. And Edna taught there some, but it was after they got out of school there. All the kids went to school there. And all the kids grew up speaking Norwegian, but then they learned English in the public school.
Mm-hmm.
And they came home and taught Grandma and Grandpa how to talk English.
Mm-hmm.
And nobody ever talked with a brogue of any kind.
Hmm.
They all talked perfect English. Grandma and Grandpa and all of them.
Isn't that interesting?
Yeah. Nobody had a brogue, like Swedish brogue or
mm-hmm.
Norwegian brogue or anything.
What church did they go to? I'm assuming they did.
Well, when the Risos and the Deerses and the Brahms and the whole bunch come over here from Germany, they were Lutherans.
Mm-hmm.
And the Risos were Lutherans. But the nearest Lutheran church was up here north of Kinsley,
mm-hmm.
where the cemetery is, but the Lutheran church has been moved to town now. Mm-hmm. So that's in here. And it was German, and
mm-hmm.
they didn't understand German, so
mm-hmm.
they couldn't go there. So they drove to Garfield, where there was a
Swedish?
Congregational. No, a Lutheran church there. Swedish Lutheran.
Mm-hmm.
And they understood Swedish. I guess it's all the same language. I don't know.
That's close. Very similar, right?
Yeah. Because Norway, Sweden, and Denmark was all one country
mm-hmm.
until the kings got to fighting amongst themselves. And then they split up. And I guess even Finland was part of that, wasn't it?
Yeah. Probably.
That my dad used to call them the Scandinavian nations. Anyway, what was we talking about?
Well, we're talking about your parents, and then
oh, yeah.
they got married.
Okay.
And where'd they get married?
Well, my folks... Well, anyway, about the church. We was talking about the church. So Grandma and Grandpa got tired of getting six kids ready and going to Garfield, which was about 14 miles, and attending church, so they joined the Congregational Church.
Here.
And the Deerses, meanwhile, had joined the Congregational Church. And the Brahms from Ophrey were mostly they changed over to the Methodist Church because there was a church in Ophrey. It was a Methodist church, and then the Katzes were all Lutherans, but a lot of them married Catholic women or men, mm-hmm. and so they, a lot of them became Catholics, and so that's about the story of the religion.
Okay.
And but Mom and Dad were married the same day Granddad and Grandma were married, on August the 3rd. But
what year, about?
In 1919.
1919?
And they lived, they moved on to this farm on the west half of the section where my mom lived when she was a kid. But she grew up on the east half, and they lived on the west half. And the old man Deers owned, from Oliphant's veterinary clinic, clear east of Stoddard's, he owned two sections there. And he had, they had four kids. The mom had four siblings in that family. Mm-hmm. She had a lot more in the Katz family. Anyway, when the old man Deers and Grandma Deers died, they gave each one of those kids a half section of land. And we lived on the one that Andy Deers owned. And then Fred Deers got the one that Mom grew up on. And Mary McKee got the one next to that east. And Bill Deers got the next one. And my mom got $1,000 out of the estate. And when the Katzes settled their estate, there was seven kids in it. And two of the Katz boys, Bill and Chris, got all the land, all the money. The rest of them got a dollar apiece. Anyway.
What did your parents do? Were they farming? Did they have cattle? A little of everything?
Farming and cattle. Mm-hmm. Dad farmed that half section. Then he farmed a 31 acres on Fred's place, on the just a little east of the half section line. And then he farmed 52 acres north of where we lived that belonged to Minnie Matthews.
And this is wheat?
What?
Is this wheat he's growing? Wheat?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay. Oh, mainly he tried corn and just like all farmers, he tied milo and everything, you know. But it was so dry during the 30s, couldn't hardly raise nothing. And I remember he had some corn during the 30s, and Bill Kuhn had a one-row binder, and they bound this corn. It made a nice stalk, but the only place it made any ears was in the mud hole where there was more water, you know. The rest of it was spotter, but it was good feed for the cattle.
Well, tell us a little bit what it was like growing up back there. Then you have the 30s, but what was it like living on the farm?
Well, in the 30s, I was born in 26, and I was 5 years old when we had the best wheat crop Dad ever raised, and he ran out of granary space, and he had a lot of granaries, but he ran out of space, so they piled it in the yard. And to me, 5 years old, it looked like a mountain, you know.
Yeah.
Because it was such a huge pile. And then he hauled it to town with a Model T truck, and wheat got down to 10 cents a bushel. And Dad had the transmission go out of this Model T truck, and it cost him $60 to get it replaced. and a truck held 60 bushels. So it took him 6 truckloads of wheat just to pay for that transmission.
And did he bring it into Kinsley? Is that where he did business, or?
No, he hauled the wheat to Offerley.
Offerley.
Because it was much closer.
Closer.
But he probably had to get the truck fixed in Kinsley. Yeah, we went to Kinsley a lot.
What do you remember about the dust storms or whatever in the?
Well, I remember in our house when I got a little older and my sister Isla got a little older, they only had 2 bedrooms, so I slept in the living room, or in the front room it was called. It just had a little single bed over on the east side for me. And I remember during them dust storms, Mom used to bring a wash rag in, wet wash rag, and lay it over my face so that I wouldn't smother, you know. Mm-hmm. And, of course, I was a good sleeper. I never knew when she'd done it or anything.
So how did your family survive during that time?
What were
the hardships?
We milked cows.
And you were able to keep the cows alive?
Well, yeah, we get rains in the dirty 30s, but they would be floods. Mm-hmm. It rained 5, 6, 7 inches at a time, just downpour, and the water would all run off, you know. And because I knew it rained a lot because those big rains, because I remember fixing the fence. Our fence ran through, it went through the Coon Creek. Let's see, 1, 2, 3 times. And I remember fixing that fence, and we had to fix it. It seemed to me like 2 or 3 times a summer, because we'd get these wild rains.
And it'd wash out,
yeah. And you had to fix it so the cattle didn't get out, you know. And it was a pretty trying time, and I remember in 1938, we had some nice wheat coming, and it was about 3 foot tall and looked like it was going to make a really good crop. And Dad and I was driving by one day, and he said, "Uh-oh." I said, "What?" And he said, "The heads are turning white." And the heads all died because it didn't have enough moisture. And then in 1940, all the wheat froze out. We had no wheat. And 39 wasn't. Just got a few bushels, enough for seed wheat. And a lot of times, Andy Deers wouldn't take his third of the wheat, so Dad would have enough to not buy seed wheat, you know. And in 1941, we raised a good crop. And the wheat was so tall, it was heavily black hull wheat, that Dad and I went and bought from August Ploger, and he gave him $1 a bushel for this wheat. And we got 100 bushel, and Dad had to borrow the money from Grover Fields over at Offerley.
A bank?
The Offerley Bank. It was a Farmer State Bank then. And he had to borrow $100 from Grover Fields to get it. And we planted, there was 220 acres of farm ground on that half section. And we planted all of it, and that 52 acres and that 31 acres with that 100 bushel. So we didn't put it on very thick. But like I say, in 1941, the wheat was so tall that my dad and I was out in it one day, and we got lost, and Dad had to lift me up so that I could see where the road was.
Hmm.
You know, we walked into it and wasn't paying attention where we were going and was looking at it. And like I say, the wheat was up here as high as our head. And to make a long story short, it all fell down. We got a wild storm from the southwest one night, and the wheat all fell down. But it was still laying. It was so thick and big that it was still laying like a foot thick. And so we didn't have any trouble cutting it, but you had to go really, really slow. Mm-hmm. because the combine was the Baldwin combine, 12-foot combine, pull type, and we hadn't cut one round before the motor conked out on it. And then Dad went and bought a motor from Armengol that was off of a, well, it was the same motor that, it was off of an International Combine, but it was the same motor that came on a 1020 tractor. And it was a pretty good four-cylinder engine. Had a lot of power. And we had V-belts on the combine, and if you slugged the cylinder, the motor didn't stop. The belts just slipped. They just smoked. Anyway, so we finally got the wheat cut. And like I say, it was pretty good wheat. But I don't remember what it made exactly. But I remember when we cut the last swath, there, you never seen so many rats in your life that come out of that wheat field. And Dad said, that's a good sign. He said, I haven't seen a rat for 10 years or more. And he said, that's really a good sign because we're going to have good crops for now. And all through the 40s, we had good crops.
So you would help him plant and harvest. What other chores did you have as a young
Well,
boy?
Dad got the blood poison in 1935. So I started running the
now,
tractor.
What is blood poison?
Blood poisoning. Well, he was fixing fence, okay. And he pricked his thumb underneath the nail with one of them barbs, and he didn't think nothing about it. But about several days later, it started really bothering him. That thumb did. Started hurting. So he went to Doc Armitage, who was the doctor here in town then, and Doc thought he had what they call a bone felon, because his thumb didn't look bad, it wasn't swelled up, it just hurt. And he thought Dad had a bone felon, so he gave him something to take, some kind of medicine or something, and sent Dad home. And the next morning, which was on Saturday morning, I think it was Saturday, Dad had three streaks running up his arm. And anyway, he called Doc, and Doc said, get in here as fast as you can. You've got blood poison. And Doc Armitage had probably the first Lincoln that anybody ever heard around here was a 1935 Lincoln V12. It had 12 cylinders. And while the cylinders probably weren't very big, 12 cylinders is a lot. And so he took Dad to Dodge to St. Anthony's Hospital, and he drove 120 mile an hour all the way over there. But the road didn't run like it did now. It ran from here to Ophrey by way you went west from Kinsley on First Street, and then south to Ardell, and then back west, and then back south, and then through Ophrey. It ran to the west edge of Ophrey, 2 miles south, and then west.
Was it all dirt at that time, or had it been paved?
Most of it was dirt. Or sand road. And when they got over to Dodge, they made it in about 20-some minutes. And I don't know how you could drive that far. But like I say, this Lincoln would really run. And Doc Armitage was in a hurry. And they got over there, and Dad got out and fell down. His knees, he was so scared
from the ride that
his knees wouldn't hold it. And he just fell on the ground. But this Doc Armitage was a kind of guy. He was really quite a fella. I remember one time Darryl Smith was a big guy, and he and Laverna came over for dinner at our house, and Dad had some homebrew that he'd made, and so him and Daryl drank some homebrew before dinner, and then Mom had a great dinner. She was a good cook. So Daryl ate a big dinner, and then Dad had watermelon, so he ate a lot of watermelon, and then all of a sudden he had this terrible gas. And so they jumped in the Model A Ford, and Dad took him to town. And when they got out here west of Kinsley, about where the bridge is on First Street, Daryl said, "Fritz, you gotta let me out." Said, "I can't stand to sit anymore. I'm gonna have to walk." So he walked from there into Kinsley, where his mother and father-in-law, their name was Norris, and they lived in the house that cornered the courthouse, the northwest corner of the courthouse grounds. The house that's cattywampus from it, that's where the Norris family lived. And they were Laverna Riso's.
What street
folk.
Would that be? Manson. No. Northwest. Not Manson Street.
That's 8th, isn't it?
Okay, 8th.
Yeah.
8th Street? Okay.
8th Street. Mm-hmm. So anyway, Dad and I went down to get Doc Armitage, and Doc was asleep. And he lived in that octagon-shaped house.
Oh, okay.
That's over there north of Fort Garage. Mm-hmm. And so he got up and came to the door, and was kind of yawning, and he said, "Hello, Fritz, what do you want?" Well, Dad said, "Hurry, Doc," said, "Daryl's dying of gas." And so Doc said, "Okay, I'll get ready." So he went in and washed his face and put a nice white shirt on and a tie and put his clothes on. Dad said to him, "Hurry up, Doc, hurry up." Said, "Daryl's going to die." And put his suit on, you know, and the shoes and everything. And so we went out and went up to Norris's, and Daryl was walking around and around the house. And he was a big guy, probably weighed 300 and maybe 50 pounds. And he's huge. And so anyway, Doc got him and took him in the house and pumped his stomach, and Daryl lived. But he was married to Laverna Norris, who later on they got a divorce, and then when Uncle Pete's wife and son got killed out here west of Kinsley by the El Capitan in 1938, then he and Laverna got married. And they were married until she died and he died.
Okay, are there any other stories about your childhood you'd like to have on this? Anything?
Well, the main thing about my childhood is we lived fairly close to the schoolhouse, and so I like to play with the kids, and my sister Isla went to school there. She was older than I was, 3 years older. And so I knew they had recess at 10 o'clock and 2 o'clock. So I would try and be over there when they had recess, and sometimes I'd just stay in the morning and then go home for dinner. And of course, Mom knew where I was at, and she wasn't worried. And so it was a good deal. But Dick Lewis's wife, Kay Kingery, was the teacher, and she wasn't married then. And those teachers were only 15, 16 years old. And but they went to something they called a normal school or something, and to be able to teach. And I think it was in Emporia, wasn't it?
Could be, yeah.
Yeah. Anyway, my Aunt Edna went to that too. And I don't know how old she was when she taught, but anyway, Catherine Kingery was the teacher, and so when she was going to get married, so she, when her term was up, she told Prosner, Can't think of her first name.
Cordelia?
No. Anyway, it don't matter. Her name was Procer. I'll think of it in a minute. Anyway, she told her, she said, you might as well put John Jay in school because he's over here all the time anyway, peeking through the window, disrupting things. And so I went to school when I was 4 years old, to the first grade. And, of course, everybody didn't think I'd make it, but it didn't make any difference because I was busy and in school where I wanted to be. But I graduated out of the first grade, and I passed before I was five, because my birthday was on the 9th of April, and school got out the 1st. So it made me a year ahead of myself all the way through school. Mm-hmm. And everybody thought I was the youngest one in the senior class, and I did too, because nobody ever challenged it, because I was only 16 years old when I was a senior. And when I graduated, I was 17 years old by 1 month. And when we had our 20th reunion, everybody was talking about how old I was and all that crap, and found out that Doris Westfall was 2 months younger than I was. And she lived about, she lived 3.5 miles west of St. Pierre and Paul. That's where she lived. And their school was directly across the section from where Marge and I lived for 45 years. And I think they probably sent her to school because her mother had something like the dropsy, because she would go to sleep. You could be talking to her and she just like that, and she was asleep. And you couldn't wake her up. She woke up when she was ready. But it was amazing. And I think they probably sent her to school to get her
safer,
so she'd be safer. Yeah.
Did you have any chores as a you know, like from five to, besides you were planting and harvesting, what other chores did you
have? Well, when I was old enough, Dad taught me to milk cows.
Okay. How many cows did you have?
Well, we generally milked 8.
And what'd you do with the milk?
We separated it and fed the skim milk to the hogs, and we drank some of it. And then the cream we sold. And that's the only source of income we had that amounted to anything.
And where did you take the cream?
We brought it to Kinsley or take it to Offaly.
And went on the train.
And they went on the trains. And I remember we used to get $3 or $3.50 for a 5 gallon can of cream.
Do you remember the creamery that you took it to? The cream station you took it to?
Well, there was a creamery here in town later on.
Yeah.
But Al Nall had one. Mm-hmm. And there was somebody by the name of Westfall had one.
Okay. But you separated it yourself?
Well, everybody separated it themselves.
But then they brought it in.
They had separators, right. Yeah. And Uncle Pete milk cows too, and Earl Winchester worked for him, and Earl was a wonderful singer. Mm-hmm. He sang at the Rose Bowl one time in California. And these separators, you had to turn them a certain RPM, or the cream would be too thick or too thin. And Earl had trouble turning this thing the right speed, and so Uncle Pete thought of this song, I'm a pole of my pretty little poppy, ba-dum, ba-dum, ba-dum. And so Earl turned to, and he'd sing I'm a pole. And so the cream was just right, see? See, if you turned it too fast, I think, then it was too thick.
Took too much out.
It took too much of the milk out of it. And then if you turned it too slow, there was too much milk left in it. They had to be turned, I don't remember what it was, how many RPMs of minutes, you know. But it was, you had to turn it that way or it just didn't work right.
And you had a garden, I assume?
Oh, yeah. And
did that you
was
work
my,
in that?
That was my job when I was a kid, was to water the garden. And the way we had to water the garden was, we had a windmill, and you could either run the water through what we called a milk tank in the wash house where we kept all of our perishables, mm-hmm. you know, milk and meat and eggs and everything.
Keep it cool.
Keep it cool. You put it in something that wouldn't leak, and then you pressed it down in the water, and then you weighted it down with rocks so that it would stay, because water has a tendency to buoyant things. Mm-hmm. Anyway, it would run in the milk tank, and then we could run it into the garden or into a little pond that we had there. Or you could run it from the windmill down to the tank by the barn. And then if you wanted to water the trees, we had cherry trees that run east from the windmill, and there was a slight slope in the ground there, and so you could water the trees also by running the water mm-hmm. down there. Or you could divert it two places at once, because the windmill put out, the wind blew a lot,
yeah.
and the windmill put out lots of water. And my job in the garden was to ditch it around so that it would run, you know. And so I was pretty busy. And I remember one day I was out in the garden and it just all of a sudden got dark. I mean, it was a nice bright day and all of a sudden it just got dark. And the dust clouds were blowing in from the west and it just got pitch black. Right in there, like 4 o'clock in the afternoon.
Did you run to the house?
You bet.
Did you have the things around the windows and to keep the dust out?
Well, we had a pretty good house. Mm-hmm. It was built new for Fred and Jenny Deers when they got married. And I don't know when they got married. It was sometime in the teens, mm-hmm. 1910 to 1919, somewhere's in there. But they lived in this house for a short time. And then Fred became a banker in Offerly. And so they moved to Offerly and lived in Offerly. And so Dad and Mom got to move in that house.
And the house was pretty tight.
And it was a nice house. And my dad probably made the first air conditioning that was ever made. He took a run of hose from the well, from the windmill, up to the big, there was a big double window in the house, and it went into the dining room and living room. And he hung burlap sack over that, and, you know, Mom sewed it so it would fit the window, single mm-hmm. burlap. And put a pipe up there that had holes drilled in it, and it would run down the thing, you know. And it...
evaporative cooling.
It sure made the house nice. Because we had no electricity. Well, we had electricity because Dad had a wind charger. He had a 6-volt wind charger and had batteries upstairs in the house. And one of them one time blowed up in the house. And... was quite a mess because battery acid not good for anything. Mm-hmm. And it was quite a job to clean that up.
When did you get electricity? On the pole?
We never did have
never
electricity.
Never in that house.
In 1941, we moved off of that place down to Grovey Foltz's place, 2 miles east of Ophir. And it was about 3/8 of a mile from the electric line. And so Dad asked a guy by the name of B.K. Brown that was running the Kansas Power and Light Company if we would wire the house if we could get electricity. And he said, yeah, no problem. Well, So we wired the house, had AutoStack come, and we wired the house and drilled a well next to the house by hand and bought an electric pump, not a submersible pump, but a jet pump, so we could have water in the house. And we lived there from 1941 to 1946. Never did get electricity.
Because of the war?
Well, I imagine that had something to do with it. But if it had been me and I'd have went to all that trouble, B. Craig Brown would have been in bad shape, or I would have been. One of the two. Because that's a lot of work and a lot of expense to wire a house and dig a well and buy a pump and everything and then not get anything.
Well, I think they took all the copper and the metal for the war effort, and then there wasn't any, you know, for people to get to the hot. We had somebody else we interviewed that didn't get electricity for
that. So you don't think there was any lines built after 41?
I don't think during the war there were too many. Maybe in town.
There was.
Yeah.
There was.
Who was it? It was Mrs. Not McBride. McLean, was it?
Maybe. Yeah, McLean.
Yeah, and she agreed to marry Mr. She was a city girl, and the electricity was coming in, and so they got married and moved out, you know, by Lewis, and.
Which one is this? Bob McLean's wife or?
No.
Bill?
Firm Bill.
Bill?
And, yeah. And then they didn't put the electricity because all the metal was going to the war then. And of course, she had two or three kids before she got electricity.
Yeah.
But, okay, let's see here.
Well, anyway, we never got electricity. And so I never had any electricity until I went to the Navy.
Right. And how old were you when you went in the Navy?
I was 18.
18. Yep. Were you drafted? No. Yep. Were you going to be drafted, I guess?
No, I had to wait a year after I got out of mm-hmm. high school mm-hmm. to be drafted. And then they drafted me immediately after I was old enough. And but this old Minnie Matthews I was telling you about, she rented me the rest of that half section of land that, except for the pasture. So she wrote a card to Dad and said that maybe if they rented it to me, that the Army wouldn't get me. Well, it did. This old Gil Matthews had many wives. I don't know how many. But he was a registered Hereford man. Lived out here where J.D. Foster's place is now, West Kinsley. And Clarence's son told me every time his dad got remarried and divorced, it cost him a $10,000 bull. Anyway, this old Minnie was really a nice, it was his Gil's first wife. She was really a nice person.
Okay, so where did you go to high school?
I went to high school in Kinsley.
In Kinsley. Yeah. And you graduated in what year?
In 1943
you graduated. Is there anything you'd like to tell us about your high school career?
Well,
were you an athlete?
I made no. I wasn't. I went out for football, and I got home late to milk the cows. And Dad said, "Where you been?" I said, "Well, I went out for football." And he said, "Well," he said, "you can't do that and milk cows." So we didn't do that anymore. So I never went out for football, and I was too small for basketball. Mm-hmm. I was only about 5'9" and weighed 150 pounds when I got out of school. So I wasn't. We had huge guys playing football. We had a guy named Richard Cook. He weighed probably 250 pounds. And Mick McCune was a big guy. He probably weighed 200. And Bob McCune, his brother, was tall. And he played a lot of basketball. And he was probably weighed 190 or so. We just had plenty of big guys to play football. And
what do you remember about high school?
Well, I remember the first time I saw my wife I knew what I wanted. I wanted her.
And how old were you then?
I was, let me see. I graduated when I was, I guess I went to school, high school when I was 12. Yeah.
And you met her when you were 12?
Yeah.
And you knew at 12?
Yeah. You bet I did.
So you were there when the fire took down the
school? Yeah. Well, I went to school. I think I started in 1940 at the school. And then in 41, I don't remember. I guess it was kind of early 41. Kind of, you know, after the first of the year sometime.
Think so.
Yeah, that it burned down. Mm-hmm. Because then we went to school in the churches, in the Congregational and the Methodist Church. And I remember my sister graduated in 41, and they had the first, they had her graduation in the, down in the park, in the grandstand. Mm-hmm. I mean, the kids were in front of the grandstand. and then Marge and I were the first ones to graduate in the new school. The new school was completed in sometime in late 42 or 40, early 43. And we were the first ones to graduate.
Was Bob Wiedenheimer in your class?
No.
No,
Bob's a lot younger than I am. He's 2 or 3 years younger than I am.
Okay. Oh, maybe his class was the first that went all the way through the new school.
I remember
he'd told us something.
Yeah.
So,
I'll tell you a funny story about Bob. When I was a kid, we had a 1936 pickup, Ford pickup. And so one time a bunch of kids wanted to go to Stafford to the football game. So I said, well, I could arrange where I could take them. And, you know, can you imagine anybody riding in the back end of a pickup now, about 8 or 9, 10 kids? You'd be arrested before you got out of town.
But back then you could do it.
No. So anyway, see, I was really young. I think I was 13. And my folks trusted me enough to let me take that pickup load of kids to Stafford. Can you imagine that? They were either dumb or didn't know any better, one of the two. Anyway, so Dad told me, he said, be sure and take a tarp along. And we had a tarp that was a little bigger than the pickup. And so I took that along. And we went around town, picked up all the kids. And it was daylight then, you know. But we had to go over to Stafford to the game. And I picked up Bob Wiedenheimer last, and his mother brought him out, and she was the sweetest gal you ever saw. And she put his little warm hand in mine, and she said, now you take good care of Bobby. And I said, well, I will. And so I went out and put Bobby in the pickup, and we took off, and the kids were sitting on both sides of that pickup against the, I don't know how many there was in there. But my wife and I, Marjorie, she was in the front with me. And
you weren't married at the time.
No.
You were just
somebody else, you know. No, we were probably
you were just 13.
Freshmen or sophomore. Mm-hmm. Probably sophomores, mm-hmm. Maybe. I don't know. Because I know Bob was pretty damn young, but he wanted to go to the football game. Anyway, I never even seen Bob after that until I counted faces when we come home. And everybody was in the pickup. And so we took out with the pickup, and we got to Dillon, and it started to rain. You know where Dillon is? It's over east. It's between Maxville and St. John.
Okay.
Anyway, the highway used to go right by Dillon. And so there's a co-op, big elevator there, and so I turned in there and got under this awning that was over the scale. Mm-hmm. And we rode the storm out there, and I suppose it rained 3 inches or better, because it really rained, just cats and dogs. And thank God we was on the north side of this elevator, because the wind was in the south, what there was of it, and They would have drowned them kids, you know. But anyway, when it quit, why, they were covered up with this tarp by that time, because it was getting pretty chilly, you know. And so I got them all fixed and got them fixed so that the tarp was tied down around the edges. And I put that pickup out on the highway and I just put her down on the floor. And we came into Kinsley 80 and 85 miles an hour the whole way. And the old road used to run around by the old river bridge. And when I come around and got over that bridge and come around that curve, I heard something funny in that engine, and it was the oil pump sucking oil, and I was out of oil. But I drove it on into Kinsley, and there was a filling station there, right where the Pizza Hut is now. Mm-hmm. And so I put 5 quarts of oil in it to fill it up. That's what it holds. And took the kids all home, and everything was fine. But the next morning when I went out and got in that pickup to come to school, it sounded like hell. And I drove it down to Kinsley, and a guy by the name of Herb Brown was a mechanic in the building. The last building on Main Street on the north side used to be the Buffalo Bulk Plant. You remember that? Well, Herb Brown had a mechanic shop in the north end of that. That originally was the first Ford garage that was in Kinsley. And my Uncle John Riso, or Uncle Johnny Riso and Uncle John Mulligan owned that garage and had a Ford agency there for several years in the 20s. Anyway, I drove it into Herb, and Herb listened to it, and he said, "Sounds like all the valve springs are broken." I said, "Well, can you fix it?" And he said, "Yeah, can you help me?" He said, "It'll take us all day." So we run her in there and took the, what they call the battleship, off the top of the motor. And Herb looked in there and he said, "Yeah, every valve spring in us broke." And so Herb had a method that he could put these valve springs on without taking the heads off. And so we spent all day doing that. And of course I skipped school. But, you know, I hadn't told my dad anything about this, or mom. And of course they trusted me implicitly, you know. And we got it in and cranked her up, and boy, just run like a top. So no harm done.
Yeah.
But them old Fords, you could run them a long time after it run out of oil, because they were V8s, and the rod from them, from the piston, had a bearing on it, and then there was also a bearing below that floated, and the other rod on the other side hooked onto it, so it had two bearings in there, and enough oil was in there that it cushioned things so it didn't hurt them to run them without oil for a way, you know, like that farm. That pickup was from plumb full of oil when I left. And it didn't use oil, but it had been in there a long time. And evidently that higher IPM, you know, just ruined it. I mean, sucked all that oil out of it. Because I had her wide open all the way from Dillon. And that's about...
That's a way.
That's 40-some miles.
Quite a ways.
Yeah.
So, when did you ask Marjorie to marry you?
Well, we got engaged sometime in probably July. I'd have to think. Of 44. Yeah. I give her a ring.
So, you had graduated. It was right after you graduated.
Well, we graduated in 43.
It was a year after.
And so, Marjorie was working at the county engineer's office, and she was also the done a lot of typing for the register deeds, because Marge could really type good. She never made any mistakes. It was amazing. She could type, 100, 120 words a minute, and never made a mistake. And she used to, before she worked there, she worked for Harley Thompson, who was a lawyer. And he had a place that's no longer there, across from Circle K East. There was an old bank here. You remember that? Anyway, that's where Harley Thompson's office was. And Marge worked for him for quite a long time. And then I don't remember whether he died or whether he left Kinsley, what happened to him, but anyway, she got a job up at the county. And so one day she done all this typing for this woman that run the county register of deeds office. And so one day she thought she ought to ask this woman if she wouldn't give her a little money for it. And the woman said no, said she couldn't do that. And so Marge went to the commissioners and asked them if they would pay her a little. And they said, well, they'd think about it. Well, when Marge quit typing for this gal, she just up and quit. And so they made Marjorie county register deeds.
Because she'd been doing it anyway.
They had to point somebody, you know. So they appointed her register deeds. And so she was county register deeds when she was 18 years old. But one day the commissioners came down to see her and they said, we found out you're not old enough. You got to be 21 to be register deeds. So they fired her. And then I don't know whether you remember the gal that was register deeds in or not. But she was really a nice, she was a big, tall gal. Tall as you are, or maybe a little taller. And she was registered deeds after Marge was. And they lived here in town. And she had a couple kids. And her I don't remember what her husband done. But she was registered deeds for a long time. And Beulah Molitor was also registered deeds for a long time.
So you got Marjorie a ring.
Yeah.
Gave it to her in July.
And I bought the ring from Rex Snatterly. You ever hear of Rex Snatterly?
Oh, I know Rex.
He was a jeweler here. I think it cost, I'm not sure, but I think it cost $25. It was a nice ring, though.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, things were cheaper back then.
Yep, you bet. My class ring is made out of solid gold, and I gave $7 for it. And I don't know what it's worth now, but I still got it.
It's probably worth a couple hundred anyway.
Well, I don't know what it's worth. They don't weigh very much, you know.
And then you got married in...
Well, I got married on my boot leave. I'd never been out of the state of Kansas until I got in the Navy. And then, boom, the minute I got in the Navy, I was in Chicago, mm-hmm. Illinois, at Great Lakes. And I'd never been away from home again. I was pretty damn homesick for quite a while. And finally, as it was getting time to get out, I went in on December 1st in the boot camp, the way I remember. And I was going to get out February 11th. And so sometime in January, I asked Marge to marry me. And I was too young to get the license, so she and my dad had to go get the license. And then we got married in her folks' house. Like I said, it was a block north of the Catholic Church and the second house west. And Ingram, Reverend Ingram, you remember him or ever hear him? Well, he was the Christian Church minister. And he married us. And the only ones that was there was family. Uncle Oscar and Aunt Julia, and Mom and Dad, and Julie. And Ronald Hines was our best man, my best man. And Betty Shelley, Margie's sister, was the maid of honor.
Probably didn't get much of a honeymoon because you didn't have time.
Well,
enough,
I had a 7-day leave.
7 days.
When we came home on the train, we got here about 4 o'clock in the morning, and the conductor wasn't going to stop the train for us to get off in Kinsley. So Bob Scott got in one end of the car, and I got in the other, and we got the conductor between us. And he used to have them cords you could stop the train. Mm-hmm. And we talked him into slowing down to where we could jump off. If something had happened to us, that guy would have really been in trouble for letting us do it.
Letting you do it, yeah.
But we got him slowed down. He slowed down to about 20 miles an hour. And we throwed our sea bags off and lit. And we got off the train right there north of Brave Bath's office. That's where we got off. And so we walked down to Shelley's, and like I say, it was 4 o'clock in the morning, and we had our sea bags with us, you know. And of course, there's no telephones or nothing available, so we woke the Shelley family up, and of course, Mommy was glad to see me. So we called my folks, and my dad come in and got me, and we took Bob Scott home. They lived way out south, and down to Little Tennessee, and then we went home. We lived out in the country then, yet out there east over.
Why did you choose the Navy?
What?
Why the Navy? Why did you want to join the Navy, not the Army?
My granddad was a sailor.
Sailor, okay.
And that was the main reason. And also, I used to run a lot, but finally, I got to where I would get shin splints if I walked very far. And I didn't like walking, so I didn't want to get in the Army. And I didn't know that you walked in the Navy. Hell, you'd walk just as much in the Navy as you did in the Army. So
did you get married in your uniform? Is that what you wore?
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah, I did.
Mm-hmm. And then we were going to say, you said you were off for 7 days. Did you do any little honeymoon of any
kind? Well, the night we got married, I got off of the train at 4 o'clock in the morning. We got married at 7 o'clock that evening. And
oh,
that night we spent the night in the Laurel Walk Hotel at Dodge City.
Mm. That's a nice place.
Really posh place.
It was at that time. Yes, it was.
And the day we got married, it was 80 degrees. In February, and Ronald Hines was my best man, and we went rabbit hunting that afternoon, and then the next morning, it was colder than hell, and trying to snow and sleeting and ice on the windshield, and it was nasty weather when we come home from Dodge. And
you stay at her parents' house until you went back to the Navy?
I think we probably did, yeah. Yeah. Anyway.
And then you went back, and she stayed here when you were in the Navy?
Yeah, she stayed here.
Where did you go? Where did they send you?
Great Lakes.
You went back to the Great Lakes?
Yeah, Great Lakes,
for
yeah.
More training?
Yeah.
Okay.
And then Marjorie came up there, after we got married, and they put me in basic engineering. A lot of guys call it barely educated, but we learned to be machinists and learned to work on motors and stuff like that. And we studied Detroit two cycle diesel engines. And they're an engine that hits every stroke. And they have portholes, two sets of portholes, down around in the middle of the cylinder liner. When they hit, it goes down. When it gets past that, these blowers that you got blowing air in there, they blow the exhaust out. When the piston gets to the bottom of the stroke, it starts back up. The blowers are blowing engine in there, and they start the compression stroke. They go by them holes, and then it comes up, and the compression stroke's the last half, and they hit again. So they're really a unique kind of engine. A lot of little engines like Maytag engines were that way, two cycle.
What were these used on in the Navy?
Well, they used them on ships. They used them like they'd set. They were built so they run either way. All you had to do is change the oil pump, gears, and I don't think you had to change anything but the oil pump gears. You know, and they run, so they would set two here and two over there, and they all faced each other, and then they run, the motors run into a gearbox, and then over here they had a big gearbox, and all these four motors run into a gearbox, run back, that's what run the propeller on the ship.
On the propeller, the actual propeller.
Yeah.
And what kind of ship, now, you eventually got to a ship, right?
Well, I flunked out in this course because the chief got mad at me, because I asked a question. I asked a question, would these portholes ever plug up with carbon? And he said, well, you don't have to know that for the test. And I said, well, the hell with the test. I may have one of these on a farm tractor someday. And he said, you dumb SOB, don't you know that this engine uses 16 air to one fuel? There's no way that you could ever get the air clean enough on a farm tractor. Well, I hadn't been home 15 minutes, and Jerome Fox had a three-cylinder engine on a Case tractor. So that chief didn't know what he's talking about.
So is that when you became a fireman then?
So that's when I got on to a firemanship. Yeah. And I came out of a boot camp as a apprentice seaman, and I became a fireman second class when I got out of that basic engineering school. And that's all the further I ever went, and I'll tell you why. It's because when I went aboard ship, I went aboard ship VE Day in the Atlantic, which was May the 8th, 1945. And we went out and tried to kill a sub that was wanting to shoot up the United States. And there was three tin cans, destroyers, and an aircraft carrier, and I don't know how many planes, trying to kill that sub. And we hauled two loads of ash cans, which are depth charges that shoot off the ship, you know. Sometimes they just roll them up. And the sonar guys find the ship, what we're doing, what we're bombing. And then they roll these off or shoot them off, one or two, with a catapult. And we hauled two loads a day for 3 days. And we thought we got it, because a bunch of clothes and debris came up, you know. Well, they shoot it out through the torpedo tube. Well, we didn't get him. So we headed for the Navy Yard up in New York City. And I went aboard at Newport, Rhode Island. That's not very far from New York City. We went up there, and they took the torpedo tubes off of our tin can and put on quad 40s, which were those ACAT guns, the ones that go boom, 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 you know. And every fifth one's a tracer, so you can tell where you're shooting. And while they were doing that, I didn't have nothing to do because I was a fireman. And so my Aunt Julia, who was head of the Red Cross here, she got me an 18-day leave to come home and help my dad get ready for harvest, because it was in May. And so I got an 18-day leave, and the captain only got 7. And all the rest of the guys got 7. And when I got back, there just wasn't hardly enough bad details for them to put me to, because I was a privileged character. And anyway, then we went from there.
Now, you are on a destroyer?
Yeah.
Okay.
So Marjorie came up there and was up there. She went back with me to New York City and was up there about 2 weeks before we took off and went down to Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, for gunnery practice, to practice shooting these. And I was the second loader. I took the shells from a guy down below decks and handed them to a guy that was the first loader, and he dropped them in. And I had to, these were in turrets, and I had to run around and find this guy, because this turret would be going like this, mm-hmm. and then like this, and so you know I was mighty busy. And but I never saw any action. All I did was there at Guantanamo Bay for 2 weeks, and then I went through the Panama Canal, which was really a great experience. It's unbelievable, the Panama Canal is. And then when I come back, we went to Japan, went to San Diego first, was there for about a week, and then went straight to Japan. And we escorted the troops in to Japan. And I didn't think much about it. I was down asleep on my bunk, which was in front of the forward mess hall, in front of the mess hall. It was forward of the mess hall, and then the chief's quarters was the only thing forward of that. And I was down there sleeping. The chief come by and see me sleeping and got me up and cussed me out and told me to get back on the fantail. We were going through a minefield, mm-hmm. and the captain was going 25 knots, which is pretty fast on a ship. A knot's a mile and an eighth. We were going 30 miles an hour coming through this minefield, and they only had one channel cleared. And I went back on the fantail, and there was old guys out there that had been in the Navy a long time, back there on their hands and knees just praying to beat hell. They were scared to death. Of course, hell, I was 18 years old, what'd I know? Or I was 19 then. What'd I know, you know?
Now, was there a party when you crossed the equator the first time?
I don't think we ever went across the equator.
Oh, yeah.
Do you have to?
I would think you would. Well, no, from going through the Panama Canal, you would have Clark crossed it sometime. Quite, I mean, once getting down?
Well, I don't know. I don't remember having any party.
So what'd you do in Japan?
Well, we just escorted the troops in there. And then...
These are the occupying troops.
Yeah. And, of course, we never even seen them. The first place we stopped at was a little fishing village, and it was called Yokos. No, I can't remember what the name of that was. Anyway, I went ashore there, and I ran into Donald Matthews. This was Clarence Matthews' son from west of town, and he and I went to grade school together. And here I got off on the thing on the dock, and there he stood, and he hadn't had a haircut for probably a year, and had a beard, and you know, pretty scroungy looking. And he also had fell out of the boat coming in, because it was real rough and he was all wet. But we spent the afternoon together, had a great time. And I brought a carton of cigarettes ashore with me. And you traded for things with so many cigarettes. Not a whole pack, mm-hmm. or not a carton, just a few. And Don and I bought some nice kimonos and for our wives. And Don bought a bottle of wine, but I wouldn't drink the damn stuff. I didn't know whether it was poison or not. But he drank some of them and lived.
Sake? Did you drink sake?
It might have been sake. I don't know. I thought it was wine, but it might have been sake. But anyway, this fishing village was the damnest place I ever was. The men wore a shirt, no pants. And the shirt come down about here.
He's and the indicating women, the tops of his legs.
Yeah, and the women wore a skirt and no tops. It's the only place I've ever been in my life like that. And do you know what the toilets were?
I've seen Japanese toilets, yes.
Was it just the trench in the ground?
Covered trench.
Well, this one wasn't covered. Okay. It was just a trench with water running through it.
Running through it. The open...
open trench. Of course, if you had to sit down on it, you wanted to be at the back end of the trench so that the way the water was running so that you didn't have to watch everybody else. But anyway, then we went to Yokosuka from there, and that's the mouth of Tokyo Bay. And then we went ashore at Hiroshima after the bomb, after the dropped the bomb. They dropped the bomb when we was going through the Panama Canal, the first bomb. And the second bomb they dropped, we were on the way to San Diego. And
how was that news greeted? Did you hear? Were you on ship and they told you they dropped the bomb?
Yeah.
Do you remember?
Well, everybody was tickled to death that they dropped it. And of course, nobody knew what the hell it was, you know. And we never saw any pictures of it until we got back to the States the next December and went to a movie. That's the first time we ever saw any pictures of the bomb. But anyway, this place we went to, Yokosuka, I don't know whether it was part of that or not, but there was nothing there but one building, and it was sitting all by itself. The rest of the place was just as bare, and the ground looked like it was slick like glass, like it had burnt glass and you know, turned soil into glass, and it was just slick. Anyway, we broke into this building, me and two other guys, Packheiser and Jenner, Packheiser and Griff, drove into it, and got us three nice Jap 25 carbines and two bandoliers of ammunition apiece. Went back to the ship and they took them away from us and gave them to the officers. But I did come home with a Jap 31 gun, which is not near as nice as a Jap carbine. This 25 caliber is a little bigger than a 22. Shell, you know, and so it was really a sweet gun.
Can you remember what you felt when you saw that devastation at first?
Well, I didn't have much feeling about it. I just was glad the war was over. Yeah. About the only danger we ever was in was from mines. And then a typhoon we was in for 3 days. That was pretty exciting. I was down in the fire room for 2 days before it got to where we could get out of the fire room, and we didn't have anything to eat but a box of crackers and coffee, but we got through it all right.
I guess I should ask you, what was the name of your ship?
DD-497, the Frankfurt.
The Frankfurt.
F-A-R-K-F-O-R-D. Frankfurt.
Bird.
But we called her the hot dog.
Because of its shape?
Well, no, because of Frankfurt.
Oh, because of...
Yeah.
Even though it's spelled different.
Yeah, yeah. Anyway, it was a 1650 class, 1650 tons.
How many men?
Around 300. But when we came back from Japan, we had another 100 and... I think we had 111 guys. More than that, bringing them back, and they were mostly guys that were going to get discharged off of big ships, and then there was 11 Marines, I remember that. I think it was 100 sailors and 11 Marines, and these Marines were what they called armed guard on the big ships, not the big ships like the carriers and stuff, but the big merchant ships. They had an armed guard of Marines on this merchant ship to protect them from Japanese subs and stuff. And anyway, we ran into that typhoon, and all those guys got seasick. I guess I wasn't. I was down the fire room. I didn't see this, but I know this one guy sat in the galley passageway on a valve, and this valve was only about that wide.
About what? About an inch?
About 5/8 of an inch wide, or maybe 3/4. And it was round, you know, and it was to shut a valve off for some water or something. And he sat on that for 3 days, and he had this up in his butt. It had went up in there and got clear of the bone.
No.
And they took him down. He was almost dead when they finally took him to the sick bay, which was down in the sick bay was down in right next to their mess hall. And when it was typhoon was on, everything was battened down so that the ship wouldn't take water, mm-hmm. you know. Because in that fire room, we had a door that was battened down, and then it was behind a place on the deck, so that when the water come up over the deck, it would go by that mm-hmm. that trap door. It wouldn't matter if it set on it, but you had to have an airtight door
right.
there to keep it from leaking. But anyway, it was, and then when I got out of there, I got something to eat, and then I went up on the deck, up on the where the captain was, up in the wheelhouse, you know. Mm-hmm. And I wasn't much scared until that, but I got up there and I looked out and watched a carrier dip the flight deck.
Oh.
And this was the third day of this thing, and it wasn't near as bad as it was the first 2 days. And the dolphins have, you know what dolphins are, they have a great time. They fly out of one wave, and they look like they're flying, and they go into another wave. And they had the greatest time. It just looks like they're playing, having fun, you know. And there's just thousands of them.
I think it's all right. I have some water over there. Do you need a drink yet?
No, I don't need any drink. I need a nose deal.
How many firemen were there?
Firemen?
Well, you were a fire.
Well,
on the ship. Were,
you see, you run 8 hours on and 8 hours off, and that don't seem like much time, but that's kind of the way it was. Mm-hmm. So you were up about 16 hours a day. There wasn't much time for sleeping.
No.
But you had a watch from 12 to 8 in the morning, from 8 to 4 in the afternoon, and then from 4 till 12 o'clock. You had three watches a day.
And you served on one watch. And how many more people like you?
Well,
had your job.
Down in the fire room, I was on the burners. I cut the burners in on the, there was four burners on each boiler. And then there was, I think, two boilers in each fire room. So there'd be eight of them. I think that's the way it was. It's been a long time ago. And then there was a guy on the water checks that let the right amount of water come into the boilers. And then there was a guy on the blowers. And the blowers had to be set right. Everything had to be set right so that when you were underway, there was no smoke. Can you imagine that? Everything was set so there was no smoke. All there was heat coming out of the stacks. No smoke. If you ever got smoke, the engineering officer would come down and just chew on you something terrible.
So you were watching gauges and whatever?
Yeah.
That's what you spent your time doing, keeping everything right?
Well, things run pretty even. I mean, once you got started mm-hmm. and got enough steam up, and we had what they call superheated steam. It was 850 degrees. Can you imagine water being 800? So you couldn't see it. It was, but if you got your hand in front of it, it cut it off. I mean, a leak.
Mm-hmm.
So when we went and looked for leaks, if there ever was any, which I don't remember but one or two, they used a piece of paper on the end of a stick to look. And whenever we cut the paper in two, that was it. That was the leak. Because you couldn't see it. You could hear it, but you couldn't see it. See?
Now, during that typhoon, is it harder to keep the ship going? I mean,
No.
Just the same.
No, you got to use more steam because you have to go into the typhoon.
Mm-hmm.
You can't go crossways. You got to go in. You got to go against the wind. If you don't, you're really in trouble. One of these ships, when this ship of mine came back from the Atlantic from DE Day, or whatever it was, when they had
VE or VJ.
Well, it was DD Day, the one.
Oh,
day,
the DD Day.
When they went over.
Yeah, D
Day. Stormed them. Mm-hmm. Anyway, one of these three tin cans, they lost it off of Cape Hatteras. Coming back to the United States, they told me it lost power some way and got water down the stack. Mm-hmm. That's it.
That's it. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it just sunk it. See, but the one I had was on made it into another one, and my ship was decommissioned in 1943 in Seattle, Washington. That's where it was made.
No, not decommissioned.
Commissioned.
Okay.
Yeah, and it was made in Seattle, Washington, and then so it had to come clear around the United States, and it went through the canal, mm-hmm. and then went to Europe, and then come back to the United States before I ever got on. See, so it was a new ship. You know, it was only
a
couple years old. Or less.
And once the surrender, did you spend the rest of the time on the ship, or you had a little time left there?
Well, when we were going to Japan, we went to Hawaii first on the way, and then, you know, got oil and whatever we needed, you know, supplies. And Jim Hines, a neighbor of mine, or a fellow friend of mine, brother to Ronald Hines, my best man, had been over there for 3 years and hadn't seen anybody from Kinsley. And so I made up my mind when I got to Hawaii, I was going to go see Jim. So the guy that, I was a mess cook at that time, because everybody had to do 3 months of mess cooking when they went aboard ship. And I was getting kind of the end of it, but I wasn't over with it yet. And the guy that run the mess hall was a guy they called Runt, and he was a coxswain, and he restricted us to ship, but I was in the below decks division, and our ID cards always were in the mechanics room up on the deck where they worked on things, the engineering room, I guess they called it, or I don't remember what it was. But anyway, my card was in there, so I went down, got my dress whites on, and went ashore. And didn't see Runt on the way ashore.
You quite often didn't do what you were supposed to do, did you?
But when I came back, he met me on the gangplank and said, "Get your dungarees on, we're going up to see the captain." And I said, okay, because I knew he was bluffing. Because when your ID card's up there, you can go ashore. So after I got my dungarees on, I went to look for him, and I couldn't find him. And so I left word around the ship I was looking for Runt, but I never did find him. So the next day, I left word around the ship that I wanted to see him back on Fantail. That's where we done our fighting, because I was going to really work him over. Because he was really ornery to us. He got us up at 4 o'clock in the morning, and we scrubbed the mess hall from top to bottom and then fed everybody, and then worked all day long cleaning the mess all up, and we just worked day and night, and we didn't have to work that hard. Mm-hmm. And
so what did you do? What did you do while you were off the sheep, the ship with which Hines was it?
Jim Hines.
Jim.
Well, he had a car over there that he'd got acquainted with some old lady there, and she had a little 31 Chevrolet coupe car, and we heard over the radio that they had a scare the night before that the war was over, but it wasn't, and the guys on the ship started shooting those quad 40s and stuff up in the air, straight up, mm-hmm. and celebrating. And we were watching the movie, and I went down below because I didn't want to get hit, because I know whatever goes up got to come down someplace. And they were shooting them straight up in the air. And then the next day, they found out the war wasn't over for sure, but I went over, and Jim Hines had been doing a lot of celebrating, and he was in a barracks, and it was amazing to me. Them guys had stuff laying all over that barracks, money, stuff to eat, and you couldn't do that with the Navy. You couldn't let some money lay someplace for somebody stealing. They were the biggest bunch of thieves I've ever was with. One guy from La Crosse up here, his name was Joe Herman. He's the one that built that laundry down here on the highway.
Mm-hmm. Oh, okay.
You know what I'm talking about?
Mm-hmm.
His name was Joe Herman. He was from La Crosse.
Oh, okay.
And so we were close buddies, you know. But he was a hell of a gambler. And he gambled until he won all the money from the guys by playing poker that he was. And he paid guys to go on watch with him, for him. Mm-hmm. And the longest I ever seen him play was 72 hours.
Mm-hmm.
He played 3 days in a row. And he was so tired at the end of that time that he laid down on his bunk, and he'd won $600, and he put it in the locker underneath him, and his bunk wasn't that far above that locker, and somebody stole it. Can you believe that? That's the truth. But he was a gambling fool. he just stayed there until he got all the money, or else he was dead broke. One of the two. And most of the time, he had all the money when it was over. He was a hell of a gambler. His brother, Chris, was a friend of mine, was the head of the PFW in the state of Kansas one time. Was a commander of the state of Kansas. His name is Chris. Do you remember him? Hearing about him?
No. Well, do you have any other Navy stories, or do you want to come back home now?
Well, the only one I got is about we come back through the canal, then we went to Charleston, Carolina, South Carolina, and decommissioned our ship. And after we went through the canal, we made speed runs for 3 days to see how fast that ship would run. And it ran up there around 38 to 42 knots, which is really going. And when you went back on the back end of the ship on the fantail, the water was up here 8-10 feet above you, because the ship was dug in so deep, you know. And when you walk forward, it's just like walking up a really steep hill, because it was just, and you know, it didn't level out. It just it just stayed that way, because you had two fire rooms and two engine rooms, and these the shafts that run those propellers was big around the 30-gallon barrel, and that one shaft run clear from the forward engine room. The way they run, it was forward fire room, forward engine room, after fire room, after engine room. And this one shaft run clear from the forward fire room, forward engine room, clear back to the back end of the ship. And I remember one time a bearing got hot on it, and I had to help fix it. And it were Babbitt bearings, and they were oil. They run in oil. I mean, they had oil running to them all the time. And we had to take the cap off of that one, and it had bolts, probably 2-inch bolts holding down that cap, and there was 4 of them bolts, one in each corner of that cap, and that cap was probably 2 foot wide, something like that. It was huge. And we had to take that out of there and scrape the bearing by hand where it was at high spots, and then put it on with some blue stuff in there and tighten it down, and then when the blue showed, took it off again and then scraped the blue off, you know. So it took quite a while to do it, but after that it ran cool as cucumber. I don't know why it ever got hot. Probably didn't get oil properly or something. But
so did you get discharged then at South Carolina?
No. We were there at South Carolina from we got in there December 1st of 1945, and I left the ship sometime in April in 1946. And they sent me to Great Lakes to get discharged, and I was supposed to go to Norman, Oklahoma. And when I got out, I tried to tell them there at Charleston that I wasn't supposed to go to Great Lakes. And they just, no, nothing would have it. They knew what they were doing. Do what we say. And so I got to come home for about 7 days. And then I got on a train, went up to Great Lakes. I got up there and they said, "What are you doing up here? You're supposed to be in Norman, Oklahoma." I said, "I know it. Discharge me, please." So they did. And it took a day or two to get discharged. And then I went back, and Marge met me in Kansas City after I got out of the Navy. And we bought some furniture that we needed to set up housekeeping.
Where had she been during this time?
She was at Kinsley all the
time.
Yeah,
but was she with her parents? Or?
With her parents, okay. Yeah. And working.
And working.
Yeah. At the county, for the county engineer.
Mm-hmm.
His name was Rankin. Nice guy. But I think he had to go to the war too. And so I think Marge kind of run all the payroll and everything. She kind of run it.
Yeah.
After he left.
So you met her there in Kansas City and bought some furniture.
Yeah.
And then came home.
And we came home.
And then where did you set up housekeeping?
Well, we first lived in a house that was owned by Vera Broadbeck's dad, in an alley behind where Vera and Buford lived. And then we moved from there over to another upstairs apartment that was across from the where that Dupree girls got that building, that government building.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the ASCS office.
Okay,
we lived across the street from that for quite a while. And then I was at a international day that Schaefer and Son had, and the Schaefer and Son building, you know where it's at, was where the Masonic Lodge now is. And they had this bay, and I was sitting next to a guy that I knew by the name of Siney Mogg.
M-O-G.
Siney, S-I-N-N-I-E.
Hmm.
And he lived on a section of ground where Marge and I lived for 45 years. And he asked me what I was doing, and because I'd known him before I went into the Navy. And of course, my dad knew him. And he asked me what I was doing. I said, well, I was farming with my dad. And he said, how'd you like to farm that section that I live on? And I said, sounds good. What's the deal? And he said, well, I've asked two or three other guys about it, but none of them seemed to be interested. But he said, I'll make a deal with you. You do the work, and I'll pay a third of this. I'll pay half of the expenses. You pay half the expenses. We'll split the crop a third and a third and a third. You take a third, I'll take a third, and the landlord takes a third. And he said, we'll go half and half on the expenses. And I said, fine. So that's what we done. So before we moved up there, I had my other wheat crop to cut and help my dad. And we moved out on this place of Groby Folks's out here 2 miles east of Oakland, Marge and I did. And we lived there during harvest, and Marge done the cooking for Dad and I, and whoever we had hauling the wheat, I don't remember. Well, it was Merle Malford who it was. Yeah. Anyway, Marge had been trained to watch the cattle, too. And if they got out, to put them in. And once in a while, one of them got out, and she'd put it in. So one day, this whole herd of cattle come by. There was about 20 head of them, I think. And they were all black, and so were our cattle. So Marge went out and rounded them up and put them in our pasture. And they belonged to Mac McEwen, who was renting a pasture from my dad up on the old Will Matthews place, which was another place we farmed. And so Marge put them in the pasture, and then Mac McEwen come looking for them the next day and got them and drove them back up there, I guess. Anyway, Marge took pretty good care of everything. And but we lived there until, I think sometime, might have been in September, we might have moved up there on the place where we lived. And it had no water in the house and no electricity either. And we got our first electricity in 1950. And we wired that house, and Dad and I and Otto Stack, which is the Stack girl's house, Dad, you know. He worked for the KPNL. And then Dale Behringer helped some, which was Lyle May's husband. And we wired that house.
And that's where your children.
And that's where all our kids were born. Of course, we lost our first child. She was a girl. And Marge had her in Spearville. And Dr. Snowman was a doctor. But the baby was what they call a blue baby. Mm-hmm. The lungs weren't right. Nowadays, it would have been no problem. No. They would have probably put her on a ventilator and stuff. But they didn't have stuff like that then.
What year was that?
That was in 1946.
46.
She died in 46. She was born April 5th in 47.
47.
Yeah, 47. She died. She was born April 5th, 1947. Died same day. And
it's a hard thing.
She lived about 15 hours. And then Johnny, our oldest boy, was born in
August
of 18th of 1948. And Marge, he was born in Dodge City at the old St. Anthony's Hospital, because we didn't have no hospital here then. And then Becky was born in the brand new hospital down on 5th Street. Mm-hmm. In 1951, she was born. And then Glenn, of course, was born in the same place. And I really thought we were done having kids after Becky was born, but Betty, Margie's sister and husband, lived in Casper, Wyoming, and they moved to either Coffeyville, Kansas, or Wichita, and I don't remember which it was. I think it was Coffeyville they moved to. And so they left their two little kids with us while they were moving. And Craig, the boy, was only a few months old. And Marge kind of got the maternal instinct taking care of Craig. Mm-hmm. And Linda was only a year or two old. And so she decided that we should have a couple more kids. And I kind of fought that for quite a while. But when she finally talked me into it, she was pregnant in about 15 minutes.
Well, now the 50s were real dry, too.
Yeah, they were.
Did you have a hard time farming then?
Well, yeah. I went to work for Rex Strait in 55 and 56 because we wasn't raising anything. In 55, I think I just barely got my seed back. We had just a few hundred bushels. It was awful poor. 54, I had a good wheat crop, but I got 85% hailed out. I bought a new John Deere 55 combine, 14 foot, from Stan Young in 54. And I went up to look at it on the rail car, and I'd already been hailed twice. But it wasn't too bad. Still had pretty good wheat crop coming on. And before I got home, I was 85% hailed out. Of course, I had hail insurance and stuff, but hail insurance don't go very far. $10 an acre or something like that, you know. And I'd already had a couple other losses. But I got out of the combine deal, and then later on, I finally bought a 1954 John Deere just like it that was used. And that was about 1959, I think, that I bought it. And
so you worked for Rex Strait during
then summer. I worked for Rex Strait, running curb and gutter and building houses and stuff. We built two houses. And I run about 34 blocks of curb and gutter in Kinsley. And anything that's got Rex Strait's name on it, I push the mule on it. And when you push a mule, it's the thing that shapes the curb and gutter. Mm. And you're down on your hands and knees pushing. And then it's like doing push-ups all day long because you're stretched out pushing.
So the cement is sort of somewhat set, or?
No, it's just, there's a guy that they dump it in the form with wheel bars. They did when I worked there. And then there's a guy who goes along with a hoe, and he kind of shapes it. Takes the hole and pushes the concrete up against the back of the curb and out of the gutter, and that kind of helps shape it. And then you come along with this thing right after he's doing this, and you're pushing this mule, I call it. And
so it's sort of on top of the form.
It's on top of the forms. There's a bottom form or a top form, and it runs on the forms with an angle iron sticking down from it, and that way you shove it longer. But it's a pretty good job. And if
sounds
you ask
like
any of the Straits,
work.
They'll tell you that I was the best mule man they ever had. And I tell them that there was only because I was the dumbest deal man they ever had. But it's a hell of a job. You work, by the time you run a block of it, you're wore out. And I run a block in front of the courthouse one day, south side of the courthouse, and then that evening, we got done about 4 o'clock in the afternoon. That evening, we went down and run the foundation for Bentley's house. We got done about 11 o'clock that night. So we put in some pretty good days.
Well, it was good to be able to have a way to make some cash, though, during that time.
Well, you know what I made?
I hate to ask.
What do you think?
Let's see, this is 50...
55.
Oh, geez. Not very much.
Made $1 an hour.
$1 an hour. Yeah.
$8 a day or $10 a day or whatever it was, you know. But I didn't have to borrow any money. It helped.
So did you buy the land that you started farming?
Glenn did, finally.
Glenn did?
Yeah.
Okay.
No, I didn't buy it because those people that I ran it from were satisfied with me and I was satisfied with them. And we got along great, and we never had but one little bitty argument, and it didn't last very long, because they asked me something, and I said no, and that's all there was to it. But I lived there a long time, and the land changed hands 5 times while I lived there, but it was all in the same family. The guy that owned it was Raymond Groves. When he died, it went to him, his wife. And when she died, it went to her 2 sons. And when her one son died, it went to the other son. And when he died, it went to his wife. So there's 5 times right there. Really almost 6, but 5 times. And I knew all these people, knew them well, and we never had an argument. And they owned a section of the land out by Elkhart, half section by Elkhart, and a section at Syracuse. And when the old man came out here, when old Raymond came out here in 1905, and bought that section up there for $10 an acre that I lived on, his dad disowned it in Missouri. But the old man paid for that section in 5 years, went back to Missouri, and the old man took him back. So the next time he left, he went out to Elkhart, or to the Elkhart or Morton,
Syracuse,
one of the two, and bought either the half section or the section. The old man didn't disown him that time. But anyway, he owned them both. Well, when I went up there and rented that place that I lived on, they had hit a gas well out there on the Elkhart on this half section. There were 8 million cubic feet a day. That's a large gas well.
Yeah.
And during the war, the government needed a lot of helium. Mm-hmm. And so they took over getting the helium out of these gas wells. And the government extracted the helium from these gas wells and never paid the people for the helium. So after the war was over, a bunch of the people that owned these gas wells where they extracted the helium got a class action suit against the government and won. And this Groves family got so much money from that helium that they didn't let me sell any crops for 8 years. I cut them, harvested them, kept them in the bins at home. And before harvest, I'd haul them in the Oakley Co-op. They didn't let me sell them. And during this time, was the time that wheat got up to $5 and something a bushel. And they rode that price up and rode it down. And I tried my best to get them to let me sell that wheat for them, take the money, and pay it on, you know, me take the money, pay the income tax out of it, and then give them the rest in cash. You think they'd do it? No. They were so honest, they wouldn't let me do that. But they lost a lot of money. I know, I remember I raised some Milo one time that they got 28 cents a bushel out of it because they kept it so long.
Well, now, did you ever irrigate, or was this...
No.
This was all dry land?
No, all dry land. And I raised some good crops. And, like, of course, I got hailed quite a few times. But that one hail in 54 was the worst one I ever had. I always cut some wheat after that. But that time, the only wheat I had left was on about a 20-acre field up on the northwest corner of the section. And it didn't hail quite as much up there. And so I cut enough there to get... I think I cut... Well, I ain't going to say. I cut enough to get my seed and enough to pay the landlord a third. That's about all I got. And I tried to cut the other, and there just wasn't nothing there. But the government paid you that time. If you had a hail loss, they would pay you. And I turned those acres in, and I remember Hunk Anderson. Remember Hunk Anderson? Was on the board up there, and he was signing people up for this drought deal or hail or whatever it was. If you didn't cut your wheat, you got paid so much. And Huck had been drinking a little that day, and Dad and I went in to sign up, and Hunk said, "Did you cut any wheat?" And Dad said, "Well, we..." And Hunk said, "Shh, shh." "Don't say anything, you know." And he asked me if I cut any wheat, and I said, "Well, I..." And he said, "Shh." So he didn't count any wheat that we cut. And it wasn't much that we cut, I'll guarantee you. Because it just wasn't nothing there. After that hail, it just ruined it. There just wasn't nothing there.
How many years were you county commissioner?
Eight years.
8 years?
Yeah.
What years were that? Those, you remember?
I became county commissioner in 1970, I guess it was. I took office in 70. I think I run for office in 69. And the reason I did it, because I was against building another hospital. And a lot of people knew that. And I had a lot of Republican support because I'm a Democrat, and it's hard to get elected when you're a Democrat. And I only won the election by 13 votes. And I beat Bill Owens by 13 votes. And Bill called me up and congratulated me about winning. But I didn't stop the hospital because the people voted 3-1 to build it. And I lost a dollar, and Duke Potcher lost a dollar, and Jack Miller lost a dollar, because we all bet the sheriff, which was Leroy Brungard, a dollar apiece. He bet us that it would go 3-1. And we thought he was crazy.
He talked to enough people, must have been.
I don't know. Either that or he was psychic. but that's the way it went. And after that, I didn't try and stop it because the people wanted it, and so what the hell. So
was there any other things that went on while you were a commissioner that were big decisions?
In fact, I turned the first spade of earth for the new hospital, which is now the old hospital. And if it hadn't have been for the dumb architect that we hired, who dug the thing down some to fill the whole back of it, and he lacked 4,900 yards to get the full, that hospital would have been sitting high enough. But he dug it down, and it's actually 11 inches lower. The floor is 11 inches lower than the road out there. And if he hadn't dug the damn thing down, it would have passed. The 100-year flood did. Because it's only 11 inches too low.
You remember that flood of 65?
You bet I do.
What were you doing during that time?
Well, I was helping people cut wheat down here in the valley to get it cut. I helped Juan Eisenberg cut his wheat so I could he'd get it out of the field before it flooded. Because that was a big flood. It rained 32 inches in Colorado when that land and that dam broke.
Nope, dam didn't break.
Huh?
Dam did not break. It rained between here and the dam enough to do the flood. When we were doing our flood project, I called up to John Martin, and it filled up, but it did not break.
I thought it broke it.
Nope. We dispelled a myth.
Wasn't there another dam between here?
No, that's the problem, they said. There's only John Martin and then here, and it rained so much between John Martin and here and all the creeks going into it that all that water was from John Martin to here. No other dams. They said, when you have a dam, the engineer I talked to, he said, you really should have a series of dams because of that problem. But, of course, it's only done it the one time. But.
Well, I know it was a hell of a flood.
Yep, it was.
It actually got over the top of the river bridge out here, and they closed the highway. Mm-hmm. And, of course, the new bridge is higher now, I think so.
Okay.
Yeah. But,
Now, do you remember, let's see.
The main thing I remember about that 65 flood is I made the mistake of coming to town. Then I had to get some kind of shots before I could leave.
Typhoid.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I should have never come to Kinsley. The funny part of it was I had a custom cutter, Jim Leslie, with me from Oklahoma. He came to town with me. Then he had to get the shots, too. But when he brought his machines, they went to Dodge City and got across to come down because the flood was over up there, and then because when they were coming from Alba, Oklahoma, and they'd had to come across the South River Bridge. Harvest really wasn't. I don't remember. Do you remember what date it was? Actual date?
We should know. We have that date. We'd have to get the book out.
It was in June.
It was in June.
It had to be, yeah.
Because Galen was helping his dad farm up where he farmed, cut wheat, and then John Kinsfodder. And so we went up to Kinsfodder's because we had a little baby. And they told us to evacuate. So
you went up to staying up there?
We stayed at Kinsfodder's, for a few days. Mm-hmm. But Galen was working. He was cutting. They were cutting wheat. It didn't stop them from cutting wheat.
Mm-hmm.
Because it was north. They just took it into Garfield. I didn't have any problems at all.
Well, it was quite a flood.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
Yeah. But we had another flood that actually had more water than Kinsley, I think, when I was graduating from high school. It was either 42 or 43, one of the two. We had a big one. And it got up, that water got up to the Congregational Church corner and then went east, clear down in the Hart Addition. Had a lot of flooding in it.
Yeah, a few pictures of that one, too.
Mm-hmm. Was that 42 or 43? You can't remember. It don't matter.
43 maybe or 4. There were a series of them in there.
Well, it couldn't have been 44.
Okay.
Because I remember we were working on the junior...
So it was 43, I think.
Junior-senior banquet, and I almost cut Wanda Wyrick's finger off with a paper cutter.
No.
We were really cutting paper. and she didn't get her finger out of the underneath the paper cutter, and it cut it a little, but I seen it, because I was really coming down with that thing, you know, I was doing the muscle work,
mm-hmm.
and of course we had a little blood, but that was all. But I could have cut her finger some off.
Now, did Marjorie work while she was raising the children, or was she a housewife?
She worked at the Fraser's office when Becky was going to kindergarten, and she worked from the 1st of November until the 1st of April, I think it was. And Becky went to kindergarten for those three or four months, whatever it was. And then she wouldn't go anymore. She was bored. Because Marge had taught her a lot, and Grandma Shelley had taught her to play the piano. When she was 4 years old, she could play the piano, you know. And so she just got bored. But I think Marge probably worked maybe 2 or 3 years. Worked for George and Tieferman and his wife when they were in there. Because that's the only time they hired any help was during tax season. It's probably from 1st of November. Well, it wouldn't have been then, because yeah, it would have been. Taxes are due in November. Mm-hmm. They're due by December 20th. Mm-hmm. Maybe she worked from the 1st of December till the 1st of March, maybe. I don't know. Anyways,
yeah, that...
I think it's 3 months. That'd be December, January, February. Yeah, I think she worked 3 months. But then... Johnny was going to school, and then Becky and I think she worked at the treasurer's office for 2 or 3 years. Maybe more, I don't know. Because I remember whatever she made, she got a 1099 now.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it wasn't called a 1099. W-2, I think it was called. Or something.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
like that. Yeah. And I remember... I do remember Grover McPeel's done my income tax, and one time he forgot to put down her wages or something. Just a mistake.
Mm-hmm.
And the government
came
back and said, this is a no-no.
Well, I think we could wrap this up pretty soon. Is there anything else about your life that you want to be sure to have on this tape?
I've been extremely lucky. I could have been dead in a blizzard in 1957. There was a dug well fell in our yard, and I walked within a foot of the edge of it. And I was carrying some trash from the house out to where we had a bunch of combine wheels I'd welded together to make a thing to burn trash. And I figured it was maybe covered up, but might have been some place to put the trash, and there was. It had kind of blowed out around it, so I dumped the trash. Turned around, walked back to the house, and there was this dug well that fell in. It was about 30-some feet down to the water. And if I'd fell in that, I'd have been drowned or died for damn sure. That's the closest I ever come to getting killed.
That's right. You said in the beginning, what year was that, or what about?
1957. Because we had this blizzard, and the lights went out on the 20-something of March, 22nd of March, I think it was.
Mm-hmm.
And we didn't have electricity for a month.
That was a big blizzard.
That was a long month. Kids didn't go to school for 3 weeks, I think, something like that. Long time.
Okay, and
we had an ice storm, and every pole, and blowing like hell, every pole between here and Spearville was down. Mm-hmm. From there to Stafford, and of course north and south both ways, it is the worst thing you ever saw. I don't know how it could have been much worse. You remember?
Yeah.
And then, when did you retire from farming?
I retired in 1988.
Are you still working?
Well, I run the combine.
And harvest.
Every time. I cut all the maize last few years because we only use one combine in Milo harvest. And I've always cut wheat because we use two combines. Now, we used to have four combines, but two of them now cut as much as the four would long before.
And then Marjorie passed away?
July 26th in 2014. She was a wonderful gal, Marge was. She would try anything. She hauled wheat for me every year until it got to where I had custom cutters, kids old enough, stuff. But the trouble with my kids was all of them had asthma. And John got by good until he hauled wheat from the time he was 12 years old. But Marge was also hauling wheat. We had two trucks. And she'd meet him, and they'd stop, and John would just drive to her, mm-hmm. and she'd take him into the elevator. But but she was always willing to do any damn thing I wanted her to do, you know.
You were married 70?
Well, we wasn't quite married 70.
Not quite, 69 years?
Not quite, 69.
And you picked her out when you were 12?
Sure did.
Well, it worked.
Sure as hell did. I went with other girls, but Marge was always in the... She went with other boys, too. I had a little trouble. I had a lot of competition. I had a guy named Richard Schmidt and also a guy by the name of Dale Olson that were competing for her hand. And so I had a little competition on her.
Well, that's good. Okay.
And I was younger than both them guys. And younger than her. She took me to raise.
She raised you right, huh?
I guess. I don't know.
Okay. Is there anything else you want to add before I turn this off? And Rosetta, anything else you need to know?
No, I've had a good life. Been lucky most of my life. About all I can say. Because you live in this place, and if you're lucky... You're lucky, and if you're not, you're not.
You like living in Kansas?
Yeah, I wouldn't live anyplace else. I've been a lot of places, and no place like Kansas. It's the best.
Okay, I'm gonna turn this baby off, I hope. That's
I get my nose blown.